Case number 12-7122, Ayanna Blue, Appellant v. District of Columbia Public Schools et al. Ms. Bachman for the appellant, Mr. Schifferle for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Natalie Bachman. This is my colleague, Mark Packman. Together, we represent the appellant, Ayanna Blue. We'd like to spend 8 minutes on our opening argument and save 2 minutes for rebuttal. The first issue that Ms. Blue has raised for appeal is whether she has stated a claim under 42 U.S.C. 1983 for her rights of bodily integrity under the substantive due process.
Let me start with our jurisdiction.
We
have to get past that before we can get to the next stage. Okay.
Ms. Blue has asserted jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1291. She appeals from two judgments entered in the district court that dismissed all claims and all parties.
Well, how do we get around the problem that under Rule 54B, an order that adjudicates fewer than all claims doesn't end the action as to any unless the court certifies that there's no reason for delay, and in this court, the court certified that there was a
What happened in this case, at the time that after the district court dismissed the case against the District of Columbia, but there were still claims pending against Mr. Weissmiller, that is the time at which we filed a motion for 54B certification. At that time, the case was still pending against Mr. Weissmiller, and the district court denied the 54B motion, finding essentially that because we still had a party involved in the case, that we should proceed against him before the entire case went up on appeal. Later, on October 26, 2012, we dismissed Mr. Weissmiller, and the district court entered
an order. But you dismissed him without prejudice, right?
That's correct.
And with a tolling agreement that meant the statute of limitations would not keep running.
That's correct.
So how is that anything other than simply avoiding Rule 54B?
Well, under the law of the circuit and the law of the Supreme Court, the courts have found that dismissals without prejudice do not prevent a judgment from being a final appealable judgment.
I mean, well, in Robinson Reeder, we said the opposite.
Robinson Reeder is distinguishable for a couple of reasons. In that case, prior to all defendants being all claims being dismissed, the court had entered an order essentially allowing the plaintiff to her amend her complaint. It never dismissed the action as against all parties.
Where did it dismiss the action as against all parties here, in this case? Let me just sort of lay out what I think the problem is.
Sure.
So first, the district court dismissed the action only as against the District of Columbia, right?
Correct.
And Rule 54B says, in the absence of a certification, any order, however designated, that adjudicates fewer than all the claims does not end the action as to any or all the parties and may be revised at any time before the entry of a judgment adjudicating all the parties' rights, right?
Correct.
So as of that date, we do not have the end of the action, right?
Correct.
Then at some point, you filed a stipulation.
Yes.
And that stipulation dismisses the action, but only as between Blue and Weissmiller,
correct.
Right? And the court never entered a judgment adjudicating all the claims. There was no final judgment at the end, as required by Rule 54B. All we have is a minute order, which dismissed the case against Weissmiller. There's no final judgment dismissing the entire case.
There's not a single judgment. I mean, we view the March 8, 2012 order along with the October 26, 2012 order is dismissing the case as against
I know you view it that way, but that's not what the court said. So if we go strictly by Rule 54B, we don't have a dismissal of the action. But more important, I don't understand why. Doesn't this mean that any time any two of three parties decides that they want to evade Rule 54B, all they have to do is agree on a dismissal without prejudice and no tolling, and then they just skip Rule 54B altogether?
Well, I mean, our position is that Rule 54B is only applicable when you don't have finality as with regard to all parties.
But what does finality mean when you dismiss without prejudice and with a tolling agreement. I get the, you know, I can, I mean, in Robinson Reeder, we didn't even accept it when it was dismissed without prejudice. But now with a tolling agreement, there's no risk at all, right? In this case, you go up, you get an opinion from the Court of Appeals, mm-hmm. and then you can go back down, start the case again with Mr. Weissmuller, right?
I mean, our position is that, you know, cases in this circuit and from the U.S. Supreme Court say a dismissal without prejudice is okay.
That's a dismissal of an entire action, right? That's my opinion in Sierowski you're citing, right?
I am. That's correct.
Right. And that is a dismissal of an entire action. And it's one in which the statute of limitations continued to run. So there was risk to the parties. Here there's no risk at all. How do we, if we let you do this, don't we just obliterate Rule 54B?
I don't think so. I mean, any time you dismiss a party without prejudice, there's still some risk. I mean, we may never be able to find him again. I mean, the time has passed since we filed our initial action. You know, same witnesses and same evidence may not be available. I think the mere fact that the dismissal is without prejudice, given, you know, the law in the circuit and under the U.S. Supreme Court, doesn't mean, you know, that there's an evasion here. I mean, you still face the same risks.
Your brief said that you reached a settlement with him.
That's correct.
What's in the settlement?
I mean, it's a confidential settlement between the parties.
Well, does it have anything to do with what will happen depending upon the results in this court?
I mean, I can't speak to the terms of the settlement, but...
So you can't tell us whether there is, for example, the first line says, in order to evade Rule 54B, we have agreed upon the following. You can't tell us
one way or
the other.
Well, I can tell you that it doesn't reference Rule 54B.
But does it reference the possibility of what will happen if we reach a decision one way or the other?
I mean, I don't feel comfortable speaking to that because it's a confidential settlement, but what
I can
tell you...
But you can understand why that could make us nervous about whether we are would be authorizing an evasion of the rule if we allow jurisdiction.
I understand the concern, but I can tell you that I mean, if that's what ends up happening, if the court were to find that there's no jurisdiction, we would dismiss them with prejudice, and we'd be back where we are today.
So one of the problems I think that we have is the policy behind Rule 54 is to prevent piecemeal adjudication of claims. And under the case as it's presented to us today, I don't see what would prevent this case from going under advisement before this panel, and then you turn around tomorrow and reinstitute claims against Weissmuller. There could be an entire trial. And then if we were to send this back for trial of any claims, it would be a duplicative trial on the claims against the government defendants, and that just seems to me squarely at odds with Rule 54. So we're presented with a case that really not only seems to involve a potential invitation, at least to other parties, to evade, if not evasion in this case, of Rule 54, and also presents a risk of precisely the kinds of piecemeal adjudication that Rule 54 is designed to prevent.
And the question is, how are we going to, what is the response to that? I mean, I guess it's the same response that I gave to Judge Garland, which is that, I mean, we don't read the case law in the circuit and in the Supreme Court to bar dismissals without prejudice. I mean, in any case in which you have a dismissal without prejudice, there's always the chance that the party will come back and sue again, and that that the same issues will have to be considered again. But, you know, in both, I think Wallace and Tiernan is the Supreme Court case, and under Sierowski, in neither of those cases did the mere fact of the nature of the dismissal being without prejudice prevent.
But in both of those cases, the entire action was dismissed.
Yes, right? Right.
And in this case, actually, I kind of wonder how you got a dismissal in this case. You brought this under Rule 41A1, correct?
Correct.
Rule 41A1 refers to a stipulation of dismissal signed by all parties who have appeared, right?
Correct.
Did the District of Columbia sign the dismissal?
The District of Columbia did not, but in our view, given that the court entered an order dismissing the case against Mr. Weissmuller, whether or not the District of Columbia signed doesn't matter at this point because the court dismissed him.
So you don't think this is an A1 dismissal. You think this is an A2 dismissal?
It could be construed as such.
But that's not what it said, and the court said it was doing it pursuant to the parties' joint stipulation, and the parties relied on A1.
That's correct. The parties did. But I think, I mean, if it were to be interpreted under A1, the dismissal should be self-executing, and there would have been no need for the court to enter the order.
then it would have been identical to Robinson Reeder, and you would be out of court, out of the appellate court, right? That's exactly what happened in Robinson Reeder.
It would be, that's the second part of it, would be identical to Robinson Reeder in the sense that there'd be no court order at that point in the case dismissing. But in Robinson Reeder, the other difference is that initially the court entered an order allowing the plaintiff to amend a complaint. I mean, it never dismissed the action as against any party in that case. Here, I mean, we have a clear dismissal as to the District of Columbia as of March 8, 2012, and we believe...
But that didn't count, right? Under Rule 54B, that simply didn't count. Rule 54B expressly says whatever you call it doesn't count until the case is, until the action is dismissed against all parties.
Well, I mean, that time, we believe it was finalized to the District of Columbia, which is why we filed under 54B.
So you're not making the argument, I didn't see it in your briefs, and that doesn't sound like you're making it here, that what the district court did after you submitted your voluntary stipulation to the court was effectively to revisit its Rule 54 determination.
No, we're not making the argument. Our argument is that as of that time, the district court entered a final order with respect to the district, or excuse me, to Mr. Weissmuller, and when read together with the order that it previously entered against the District of Columbia, all parties and all issues had been dismissed as of that time, and we therefore had a final appealable judgment.
So you viewed the original denial of the Rule 54 order as the reason we're denying this is because there's still a pending claim,
exactly.
And you thought if we resolve that impediment, then we'll be in a position to treat this as a final judgment and go on appeal.
Yes, there was still a pending party at the time the 54
order. Right, and you said if we get rid of that pending party, then we're good to go.
Yes.
You seem to place some emphasis on a distinction between dismissal without prejudice and the tolling agreement you've entered into, but they're operatively identical, are they not? In terms of the open-endedness of...
Well, what we're saying is because there's case law holding that a dismissal without prejudice is okay, and by definition that means that the defendant could be sued again, that therefore a tolling agreement is also okay.
Further questions? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Carl Schifferle for the District of Columbia. This Court lacks jurisdiction because there is no final order. There is just the plaintiff's attempt to circumvent the District Court's denial of a Rule 54B judgment by voluntarily dismissing her remaining claims, which she can revive as soon as this appeal is decided. The rationale, if not the holding of Robinson Reeder, we believe applies fully here, that permitting a party to voluntarily dismiss his or her claims without prejudice in order to create an appealable judgment essentially negates Rule 54B and the gatekeeper function that Rule 54B assigns to the district court. It's not the party's function, it is the district court's function.
If you're right, let's just say if you're right, what happens when the case goes back down?
I'm sorry, if we're correct that this court lacks jurisdiction.
Yeah, what would happen with the claim that would still be outstanding?
It's my understanding that the plaintiff would be free to reinstitute that claim at that time and proceed in the action as though this appeal never happened.
Okay.
And so that's why, certainly as a practical matter, all claims have not been resolved in this action because that particular claim is just simply on hold, just waiting for a decision of this court or whatever the plaintiff desires to do to bring that
but
claim back.
But isn't that really the desirable result? If the tolling agreement said this is tolled and the case is on, the claims are held in abeyance unless and until there's a remand of the claims against the District of Columbia, at which time the plaintiff may reinstitute the claims against the individual defendant and consolidate them for trial with the claims and proceed together to trial with the claims against the city. I mean, that would actually be what Rule 54 would seek to achieve is one proceeding, not piecemeal proceedings, against so if that's what they contemplate, if that's how the order were worded, would you have a problem with our current jurisdiction?
I still would, Your Honor, to the extent that the plaintiff can revive those claims at the plaintiff's choice. Perhaps I didn't understand the question
correctly. I'm saying if they foreclosed the notion that they would revive them and try them at any time other than in the event or the claims against the District of Columbia had been dealt with by our court. In other words, either the claims against the District of Columbia are, you know, the decision throwing them out is affirmed by us, and so there's no risk of duplicativeness, or some claim is remanded and the whole case is tried together against all parties.
Right. I still think there's the same jurisdictional problem because, as Robinson Reeder, this court was concerned not to allow the parties to just hold a claim in abeyance, get the views of this court, and then decide what to do. That is not consistent with what a final order is.
To what extent do the views of this court on the claims against the government defendants affect the case against Mr. Weissmuller? How realistic is that concern that you have about?
Well, they certainly overlap. Some of the same claims that are brought against the district are also brought against Mr. Weissmuller, the substantive due process claim, for example, the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, both against the district and Mr. Weissmuller. So you have the same exact claims.
Grounds for dismissal quite different, though, distinctive to the city.
Well, potentially, not necessarily. For example, the substantive due process claim, if there's no predicate violation of substantive due process, that would apply to Mr. Weissmuller as well as the district. That is, that would be a grounds for both to be dismissed. Same is true on the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. I mean, potentially, setting aside the district's 12309 argument, potentially the district court could resolve that claim by saying it doesn't meet the elements, and so both defendants on the same
But those basis. Issues haven't been briefed before us.
I'm sorry, those issues
those
are not...
Those issues have not been briefed before us. I'm saying what the strategic advantage to be gained by waiting to find out what we say on the issues that are before us, I'm not sure there is a strategic advantage vis-a-vis the claims against Mr. Weissmuller.
Well, I think so, Your Honor. Even if there's an avenue that this court can take that doesn't necessarily determine the claims against Mr. Weissmuller, although this court could certainly say things that indicate one way or the other the strength of the claim against Mr. Weissmuller. I do disagree that, for example, we have briefed the issue of whether there's a predicate substantive due process violation.
Let me ask you about that. This is a situation in which a young woman is in a school specially designated for emotionally disturbed youth, and there's a claim that a teacher was hired after repeatedly being involved with students, underage students, in prior employment. What is the district's policy on background checks before a teacher is hired in this kind of situation?
Well, I'd be going outside the record by saying it is certainly the district's policy to conduct background checks. Within the record.
Criminal only or broader than that?
I do not know the extent of the background checks. I would believe that there's not just a criminal background check, but there's also a check of references as well. I mean, I'm speaking outside of the record on my understanding, but for purposes of 12b-6, we look at the allegations in the complaint. There's no allegation, for example, that the district doesn't conduct background checks. There's no allegation that the district doesn't check criminal background. There's no allegation that the district doesn't check references before it hires teachers. There's no such allegation. There's only the allegation that in this single instance, the background check of Mr. Weissmuller was inadequate. And that is insufficient to state a claim against the district as a municipality under Section 1983. The single instance theory has been rejected by the Supreme Court a number of times, including in the Connick case most recently.
What about a theory that if there's a single instance that is so indicative of a lack of a background check policy, or at least a lack of an effective background check policy, which I take it is what their claim is, that does raise a plausible inference that the city has a policy of background check failure. So it's not really a single incident kind of case, because we're not talking about the policymaker doing something egregious. We're talking about the policymaker's fault being failure to have the policy in place.
There's no such allegation, again, that the district doesn't have a policy of conducting background checks on its employees.
And you think it's not a reasonable inference from the factual allegations of the complaint?
That's certainly correct, Your Honor. And I would point to the decision of this court in Jones versus Horn, which we cited in our briefs. It did dismiss the case against the district under 12b-6. This court found that the allegations were insufficient to state a municipal policy that would support a Section 1983 claim against the district. And I think the analysis in the Jones versus Horn decision would apply equally in this particular case.
What's the nature of your contention that it matters whether she's 18 or not?
The nature of our contention?
Why isn't it enough to say that she's in a school for disabled children and she's disabled? Why doesn't that at least get you past the question, get her, them past that question?
Because on these allegations, it's insufficient, Your Honor. She is an adult. There's no allegation that the sexual relationship was unwelcome.
Isn't that the inference of describing her as a disabled individual in a school for disabled where the teacher has a supervisory and a hierarchical role over her? Doesn't it all suggest something that's not much different than if she was 17?
No, Your Honor. I mean, the plaintiff's complaint does not make the allegation that you suggest. That is, it would be easy for her if the relationship were unwelcome, or that the disability prohibited her from voluntarily entering this relationship, for her to allege that.
Was she given an opportunity to amend the complaint?
The complaint had been amended once before. The district court's order did not expressly give her leave to amend, but she had the opportunity.
This was a dismissal of the second amended complaint that you're talking about?
That's correct. I'm referring to the fact that there has been at least one prior amendment.
I see it says second amended complaint. I was just asking whether that's what was dismissed.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And so the plaintiff certainly had the opportunity to make the allegations that would be necessary.
Well, they made an allegation, for example, back to Judge Pillard's question, that the district has a custom policy or practice of failing to adequately investigate the backgrounds of its teachers, all of which suggests plural and not just this one particular case.
Well, I think from reading the plaintiff's briefs as well as the plaintiff's submissions below, that is their theory, that this single instance theory is sufficient. That's what they've articulated in their briefs. I would note, too, that allegation is simply insufficient to say that background investigation was inadequate.
Well, so just to take the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, they haven't had an opportunity to discovery to find out the policy that apparently you don't have the details of either today, which is, what is the scope of the District of Columbia's policy in investigating backgrounds? They have identified several instances in which this person was a teacher in public schools in the area, and one would assume that if there were a competent system of background checks, and if those allegations are in fact true, that some of that would have been uncovered, that reference checks would have been run. And so one inference is, this was just an oops. This was a situation in which one set of individuals messed up. But another fair inference, I think, from that is that there is not an adequate system in place. There's nothing, you know, in the record before us that suggests that, in fact, there is something that's checking something, let's say, more than a criminal background check. And if that's the case, there might be a basis for a policy-based liability.
Several points. I guess simply the fact that the complaint might be consistent with a
viable
theory.
Well, they've alleged policy of failure to do background checks, so they've told you, and then they've alleged a bunch of facts, which might be seen as raising the inference that that policy is, in fact, deficient.
Well, respectfully, the only inadequacy that is alleged is with respect to Mr. Wozniak. Even if it were that the screening system generally is inadequate, that is not enough. That at most states a claim of negligence. It does not show a policy by the district that exhibits deliberate indifference to a serious risk of constitutional violation.
Doesn't it depend whether the policy generally being inadequate is it's administered inadequately or it's not written down adequately? There is no formal policy that's adequate. And that's a question that I think is an open one on this record.
Well, I don't think the sort of formal promulgation of the policy would control whether the district has committed a substantive due process violation. The allegations of the complaint here are simply insufficient to show that what the plaintiff would have to show is that a policymaker knew that there was this pattern or practice of hiring teachers who were who had sexual crimes, that their backgrounds were not being investigated at all, that as a result constitutional violations were being committed in our schools, and that the policymaker took no action in response to that. That's a very high level of both fault and causation, which the Supreme Court has mandated when it's talked about liability against a municipality under Section 1983, and the plaintiff's allegations in this complaint fall way short of that. It is, in our view, just a mistake in the hiring of one individual, and it does not permit the inference to that high level of fault and causation that I mentioned is required under the Supreme Court precedent.
That's helpful. I mean, if you had an urban school district that did not have any background check investigation policy, is it your position that would not, and somebody were harmed in the way that Ms. Blue alleged that she was harmed, is it your position that one would have to show a run of different cases and sort of make the case that an urban school district would need some kind of background check policy, that it would be reasonable for them to think it would be okay not to have one?
Well, I mean, first of all, I do want to be clear. There's no allegation whatsoever that the district has no policy of checking the background of teachers it hires. That is not an allegation, and it is certainly implausible. It is certainly
a background check.
I'm sorry?
Or that it has a policy that exceeds just checking for crimes.
Right, but I guess what the plaintiff would have to show would
is
be...
Is that an allegation?
That
wasn't clear about. Is there an allegation that district has no policy other than checking for past crimes?
No, that is not an allegation. It just says that, in our view, once again, that the checking was inadequate in the case of Mr. Weismiller, and that's all that's alleged that would support a claim against the district, and it does not. I'm sorry, Ron, I don't think I answered your previous question, though.
The concern that I have is whether there might be a situation in which it's so clear that a certain kind of policy would be warranted, that the failure to have that policy alone and harm being of this sort being caused by it would suffice to allege a claim, and that you wouldn't also need to allege a run of other similar events and actual knowledge by the policymaker of that. That you can assume certain things about modern municipal policy and its requirements.
I would say essentially no.
Okay.
The Supreme Court did mention City versus Canton, one example where you give police officers firearms and you don't train them at all in how to use them.
Okay.
I mean, that might be an example, but that is the only example I think the Supreme Court would tolerate. It has to be to that level, and simply saying that they're inadequate checks of teachers' backgrounds is not sufficient under that standard. So unless there are further questions, thank you.
Thank you. Does the appellant have any time? I will give you another 2 minutes, okay?
Your Honors, I'd just like to address some of the points that were made with respect to the 1983 claim and whether we had alleged a sufficient customer practice to state a claim. I think the fundamental problem with the district court's ruling is that the district court is requiring us to plead more than what you're required to survive a motion to dismiss. As Judge Pillard mentioned, we did allege that the district had a custom policy or practice of inadequately checking the backgrounds of its teachers. We alleged a couple specific incidents in Mr. Weismiller's past employment where he had actually been fired from school districts in this area for committing the same type of sexual abuses that are alleged here. And we think that that's enough under the case law in this circuit and in the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Pembauer says that a single incident can certainly be enough if you can show that it's properly attributable to a municipal decision. The same thing with this circuit's decision in Atkinson. It said single incident is enough, particularly at the pleading stage. I mean, the District of Columbia may be correct that we have to come forth with additional facts to win on the merits, but, I mean, we're just simply not there yet, and especially with respect to what the district's hiring policy is. We think that we've alleged enough to certainly survive a motion to dismiss on that issue. One other point I'd like to make.
Take it your position is you can't fill out more without discovery.
That's correct. I mean, we would, for example, the district says we had to allege who the final policymaker was that made the decision to hire Mr. Weissmuller. Well, as far as we know and what we say in our complaint, he was hired in the 1990s. Our client was a child then. I mean, the person who made that decision, I mean, we don't even know that they still work for the district. I mean, it seems that those facts certainly would not be in the possession of this plaintiff or any plaintiff at this stage of the case. Unless Your Honor has any further questions.
I just had one question about the Title IX claim and the claim of actual knowledge.
Yes.
You have no allegation that the school principal or department director knew. You said there were rumors and people suspected. People saw them together. The way many of our cases in this and similar areas deal with that is require an allegation that the plaintiff notified somebody. But she didn't do that. It's not alleged that she did that.
That's correct. We did not allege that. Our position is that the knowledge, in terms of what constitutes actual knowledge, that's a fact issue that has to be determined through discovery.
But you don't get to discovery unless you have an allegation on information and belief, something, you know, I recognize that's difficult, but the mm-hmm. law requires that you have alleged something to make it plausible that there was, in fact, actual knowledge.
Now, well, I think the other problem of that, Your Honor, is that when you're dealing with who, you know, is an appropriate official, I think it's somewhat related to actual knowledge in the sense that some people may have authority to take disciplinary action and other people don't. I mean, let's say there was someone who we alleged, you know, knew about this, and that person had the authority to do something about it and did not. I mean, we would argue that's enough here.
Okay, but you haven't so alleged. Nobody. She told nobody.
She did not tell anyone, that is correct.
And there's no other ground alleged for actual knowledge on anyone's part.
The allegations are that people knew about it, whether or not she told him.
The conclusory legal allegations that under Twombly and Iqbal we have to set to the side, the factual allegations are people suspected, people talked about it, they went in the room hoping to find out more, but that doesn't, I don't think, rise to actual knowledge.
Well, I mean, Your Honor is correct that those are the allegations. We believe that they're sufficient at this stage.
Okay, no further questions. We'll take the case under submission. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.